So that was the theme to On Golden Pond, and that's the piece that Chris played for his audition years ago when he came to work here. This long-haired hippie came in carrying no music and wearing jeans, and I thought, oh, great. And then he sat down. He sat down and he played that, and I was awash in tears because that's one of my favorite songs, and you made my mascara run, and I'm afraid my false eyelashes are going to fall off. So there's that. And one more announcement I want to make, just so it doesn't get overlooked, and that is, have you noticed how beautiful these flowers are? Well, they are. Yes, they are beautiful. They are beautiful. But they are not as beautiful as the person that they are going to, and they are going this morning to Annette Bennett, who does so much for our centers, this quiet voice behind the scenes. Yay, Annette! Yay, thank you. Thanks, everybody. Alrighty, so, gosh, what a week this has been, right? It's been interesting in many ways, I'm sure. I think interesting is the word for it that I choose to use. And, you know, it's always again, interesting for a person in my position to do a talk around an election, particularly when we have a center where there are people in both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, both blue and red people. I never quite know what to say. I know that some people are happy with the results, some people are not happy with the results, but I know that we can all be respectful and that we can all trust the process and that we can all know that there is great work to be done, that this is a pivotal moment where there is great work to be done. Whatever side you happen to be on, we have so much goodness within us that can rise up and do exactly what it needs to do to bring forth greater compassion and healing and love and kindness in this wonderful country that we call home. So that's where I'm going with this today. And, you know, I'm still speaking about the book about Dharma that I've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. This is the last chapter today. It's a book called The Great Work of Your Life by Stephen Cope. You would think after 5 or 4 weeks I would know the title, but evidently I don't. But I love the book. I love the book. It's a fantastic book, The Great Work of Your Life by Stephen Cope. And if you haven't read it, I'd recommend picking it up somewhere and getting a good read, because it's been very helpful for me personally and helpful for a lot of the people that I know who have read it. And in this book, just to briefly recap, because a lot of you have heard this before, it's based on the Bhagavad Gita, which is the story of Arjuna, who is a warrior about to face a great battle, and then his charioteer is Krishna, and Krishna tells him that it is his destiny to fight this just war, it is his dharma, it is his sacred calling, and Arjuna does what many of us would do, he collapses on the floor of his chariot and he starts to quiver, because I have noticed in my own life, and perhaps you have too, that often our sacred calling fills us with fear and annoyance and doubt. And we say to God, what in the world were you thinking, asking me to do this? So Krishna reassures him by giving him four pillars of Dharma. We've talked about knowing your Dharma, knowing your sacred calling, knowing what it is you are to do here on the planet Earth. Everybody has a Dharma. If you are here and you have a fingerprint and you're breathing, you have a Dharma. And I often take Dharma down to a God quality, such as it is my Dharma to love, it is my Dharma to be kind, it is my Dharma to reconcile, any of those things, whatever you feel called to do. The second pillar of Dharma is to do your Dharma fully, to invest in it, and to show up and be that presence in the world, because your Dharma is trying to be you at the same time. The Dharma that you are seeking is seeking you. And as we show up and we live our Dharma finds us and expresses through us. The third one is the one that sometimes people find the most challenging. This is the third pillar of Dharma, which is to let go of results. Work your Dharma as best you can, work it fully, work it consistently, but let go of the results. And then the fourth pillar, which we'll address today, is to give it all over to God, to surrender, to know that the Holy Spirit, or that the wholeness of spirit, if you prefer, works through you as we surrender and as we allow our Dharma to express as us. So the name of this talk this morning is... Again, I don't know, but it's place your faith. Place your faith on purpose. Place your faith on purpose. I have a case of amnesia today, evidently, because I'm standing in a new place and it's completely thrown me off. But anyway, place your faith on purpose. Place your faith on purpose. And that's a double entendre. You know, we place our faith on our purpose, on our dharma. We have faith in our dharma, but we also do it on purpose. We do it deliberately. Like, I guess it was Thoreau who said, I went to the woods to live deliberately, on purpose, consciously, being aware, being mindful. We are deliberate in our dharma. And I find that it's interesting that deliberate is can also be looked at as deliberate. When we deliberate, we surrender the ego. We are free. We move past the ego, and we liberate ourselves. We connect ourselves to God, and then God does the work of Dharma through us always when we allow it. So, if there's anybody in doubt here that feels like they may not have a dharma, I believe that there are certain collective dharmas that we all share. And one of those dharmas was encapsulated so beautifully in the reading that Hugh did, and that is to remember who we are, to know who we are. You know, the guy who wrote that, Stephen Cope, remembered who he was in the subway. I'm curious, how many of you have been in the New York subways? Oh, a lot of people that are here today. I would say it's not necessarily to the human in us the most inspirational place you can find. I read them a lot, and yes, they are smelly. And there are often characters on the trains. And yet, Stephen Cope found his true self in that place of smelliness and characters and this great wash of humanity. So we can find our dharma anywhere. We can remember who we are anywhere. You know, in the book, Stephen Cope talks about who we are, which is a complete beautiful sea of awareness. That's our true self. We are that sea of awareness. And he uses the metaphor that perhaps some of us have heard about the ocean, that when we look at the ocean, which those of us who live in Ventura County have the pleasure of doing on almost a daily basis, but we look at the ocean and there are waves, right? And today, I don't know how many of you saw the ocean today, but there are lots of little waves, lots of little choppy waves, which is my favorite look of the ocean, when there's lots of little choppy waves. And that is the ocean individuating. That is the ocean, the substance of the ocean, expressing itself as an individual wave. And we know that the wave is a thing and that the wave is there, but that the wave is also part of the ocean. And the wave comes in and it goes to the tide, it goes to the shore, and then it comes out again and it resumes being part of the ocean. And that is very much like unto our life, that we are this individuated wave of awareness, and at some point we express ourselves and we come out as this wave, and then we come back and we seep back into the ocean, where we remember once again that we are the ocean. It also reminds me of Rumi meets Mother Teresa. Rumi saying that, or Mother Teresa saying that we are just a drop in the ocean, and that's a beautiful, inspirational thing to think, that we are this drop in this ocean of life. But Rumi says that we are not just a drop in the ocean, we are the ocean that is in the drop. And so we are all of these things, and that is our true self, and that is our true awareness of who we are. And so we rest in that presence, we rest in that knowing that we are the ocean, and we allow that, the expression of that ocean that we are. So, you know, before I talked about selecting a word of dharma, what is your purpose, what is your calling, and if it's love, and we say, yes, I am one with the ocean of love, I am the ocean of love, I am a wave of the ocean of love, I am a drop in the ocean of love, and the ocean of love is in me. The next thing to do is to allow that wave or that drop or that ocean to pour through us. And we allow it to pour through us through the great and right use, the noble use of our consciousness. We use our consciousness to know what it is, to surrender to what is, to know what is, and then to allow that consciousness to move us into action, to live as if the truth was true, as Richard Rohr is so fond of saying. We live as if the truth of true. And so no matter what is going on, we live like the truth of our dharma is true. We apply it to all circumstances, all situations. It's kind of like Bill Hadris and his helium balloon that he expressed so beautifully this morning. If you missed the children's message this morning, Bill did another balloon release, and he said that helium was like joy, and joy lifts us up just like helium lifts a balloon up, and it's still up there on the ceiling. It makes me so happy to look up there and see a balloon. Sorry for the folks at home, you can't see the balloon, but just trust me, it is there. Like God, it is there. So, and the thing about helium and joy is that it always works. Helium is not going to say, oh, you know, I'm in the subway, I'm not going to float up. Or I'm in a hospital room where depressing things are happening, I'm not going to float up. Or I'm in a very stressful time in American history, I'm not going to float up. And the same thing is true with joy. Joy is an omnipresent reality that always works when we allow it. And so we live as if the truth of love is true. We live as if the truth of joy is true. We live as if the truth of peace is true. And we know that this is indestructible. These God qualities cannot be destroyed. They can only be blocked if we allow ourselves to block them. So we open our hearts and we allow these qualities, this dharma, this sacred calling, this purpose to flow through us in all things, all of the time. Now that may be easier said than done. What Stephen Cope recognizes in his wise book, he gives us two strategies that will help us to live like the truth is true and to express our dharma fully and beautifully. One of those strategies is to walk by faith, and the other strategy is to bring ourselves to zero. And I'll address both of those. The first one, to walk by faith. This is, I'm not sure if it's in the Bhagavad Gita too, but I do know that it's in the Christian Bible. And I'm going to read a paraphrased version of the quote from the Christian Bible, from the New Testament. And it's from the book 2 Corinthians. And it says, these are two verses actually, maybe three. It says, so we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, or the ego, Paul used the word body or flesh often for ego, we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the ego, we believe ourselves to be absent from our true nature. We believe that we're separate from God, in other words. We are hypnotized by the illusion of separation when we are in our ego. So we must walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yes, we are confident and well pleased to become absent from illusion and to be present with truth. You understand that? That when we are caught in the ego, we believe in separation. But when we join ourselves with spirit, when we allow spirit to work through us, then we are separating ourselves from the illusion only, and we are at peace and at oneness with everything, and then the spiritual qualities of our dharma, of our goodness, of our grace can flow through us powerfully when we walk by faith, not by sight. And we all know that, right? We've all experienced that, where we don't have any evidence that our soul's calling or something that we choose to do or something that we really want to do or something that we want that would be good for ourselves and good for humanity, we have absolutely no evidence that it's working. And it's at those times when we have to walk by faith, knowing that the truth is true, even when we can't see it. Knowing that helium will lift up a balloon even when we can't see it. And knowing that we are one with the ocean of love, even when we don't necessarily feel it, we go into a deeper place and we know that and we trust it because it is true. I am here to tell you that I believe this with all of my heart, that it is true. We have many things to distract us from this truth. Dr. Michael Beckwith calls it weapons of mass distraction. There are many weapons of mass distraction out there that will tell us that we are separate, that will tell us that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, that will tell us that there's no hope. But again, we go within. We become that helium. We become that ocean. And we know that we walk by faith, not by sight. We don't have to look for evidence. We just trust. Learning to trust will make us happy. Learning to trust will help us take one step after another. And often the steps are very much like, you know, that Indiana Jones movie, I don't remember which one, where he's stepping off the cliff, right? And it seems like there's nothing there. And then something comes to bear him up, like angel wings. I believe it's another step. It's not really angel wings, but it's that principle that we often have to step and wait for something graceful and beautiful and true to bear us up, one step at a time. I'm also reminded of driving, you know, driving that when you're driving, you don't see the whole route. You don't see, okay, I'm going to San Diego, and I can see the 405 from my house in Santa Paula, and but you don't. And you can't see farther than your headlights will go, but you just keep driving in the right direction and trusting that the road is there, and it will be. It will be. If we are aligned with truth, that road will be there. Now, one of the things that Stephen Cope uses in his book, one of the examples of someone who walked by faith and not by sight, was the beautiful Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman, who by all earthly measures should not have been the great leader that she was. That she was born a slave, that she was sold many times away from her family, so she was distant from her family, that she was about to be sold again, and she just started feeling that it was her duty to leave the plantation, to escape, and to go up north where she could be free. And without having any knowledge of how to do this, other than, as the book said, that she knew a lot of songs that had a lot of subtle hints about how to be free, you know, follow the dipping gourd, which is the Big Dipper, follow the North Star, but she was able to escape, and by following the river and following the North Star and looking for the dipping gourd and feeling the side of trees for which side the moss was on and becoming part of a network of people that helped her, a network of, they said, mostly Quakers that helped her escape, not knowing where the next group of people that were going to give her food or shelter were, she just kept moving and kept moving and kept moving, walking by faith that she would ultimately get to her destination, walking by faith that it was her duty, her sacred calling to be free. And then once she was free, that was not enough for her. That was not enough for her because she had loved ones that were still in captivity, that were still enslaved, and she needed to go back to the South several times to get those people out of freedom, out of slavery too, help those people walk by faith, not by sight, into a greater, more expressive, more free and beautiful life for themselves. She did that. And then she became a spy for the Union Army, where she helped people escape from in greater numbers. There was one story about how she had she facilitated the escape of 750 slaves from a plantation on a boat, and that the master was humiliated. And I say, good, good. That's good. Happy he was humiliated. But she facilitated them. And I don't know if I read this correctly. I need to research it more, but it sounds to me like she didn't lose one person, that everybody that she rescued made it to safety and made it to freedom. And she had no idea of what she was doing. She had no long-term plan, but she had this uncanny ability to trust guidance in the moment and keep taking one step in front of another, one step at a time, one step of walking by faith and not by sight. And so I ask all of us today, you know, how do we start? How do we become like that? How do we express our dharma and walk by faith? Walk by faith. And I think I just said it. I think we take one step in the direction of our dream, one step in the direction of our dharma, and then we wait, we watch and pray, and we wait and see what the next step is to be, and then the next step, and the next step, and the next step. So contemplate that with me, if you would, over the coming week. What is my dharma? What is my next step? How do I realize this? And it may be so small, it seems insignificant, but small is not small. You know, we know that in this center, and we know that from many things that I've shared over the years. Small is not small. Your small step is just a springboard to the next step. And when we combine all of those steps together, small suddenly becomes immense. And that is the truth. That is the truth of human nature, human divine nature, working in concert. That is the truth of Dharma expressing. So that's walking by faith and not by sight. The other thing that I mentioned, one tool to help us allow spirit to move through us, to allow our Dharma to move through us, is the idea of reducing ourselves to zero. Now, I know in religious science, and many of us who are not in religious science, struggle with the idea of somehow being unworthy, and struggle with the idea of thinking, well, I am nothing. I can't do what I need to do because I'm nothing. I am not enough. And yet that's not what I'm talking about by reducing ourselves to zero. Reducing ourselves to zero means, again, letting the ego go, letting the ego do what it does in a kind and embracing manner. You let go by embracing the ego and just recognizing that it's part of life, that it's part of being human, and that there's actually a certain beauty to it. We let the ego go, and we allow that greater yet to be to flow through us in the spaciousness that was created by letting the ego go. A person that they use for an example of this, a famous example of this, is Gandhi. Gandhi was beautifully able to reduce himself to nothing, to zero. I didn't know this about Gandhi. You know, when I spent time at the Gandhi Ashram in India, and when I was there, they really talked about the more successful parts of his life, because that's really what he's known for. But according to Stephen Cope, his life did not start out easily, that he was small, he was bullied as a child, and that he became a lawyer and was not particularly successful at that either. He was like the barrister with no cases because nobody wanted him to work on their cases until he got to South Africa. Then he figured out what to do. But he did not have what some would call a successful early life. Back when he was a child, though, things started to shift for him in a very subtle way. Remember what I said about small steps? He was talking about being afraid of the children that were bullying him in his school or in his neighborhood. And he had the Indian version of a nanny. And she said to him, you need to have a mantra. Have a mantra, and that will give you courage. And the mantra that she gave him was Rama. Rama, which is a name for God. And this Indian nanny said that a mantra is something that tames the ego. A mantra tames the ego like an elephant with a stick in its nose, in its snout. She said that if you walk through a marketplace with an elephant and it doesn't have anything to hold on to, it's going to be grasping at something over here. Oh, look, there's a mango. It's going to be grasping at something over here. Oh, it's a coconut. It's going to be grasping over here. Oh, here's something else that's delicious, a pomegranate. I don't know. I can't remember what fruit they have in India. But anyway, the elephant is going to be grasping at things all around. But if you give it a bamboo stick and it likes the bamboo stick, it's going to hold on to that, and then it won't grasp at things. It won't grasp at the worldly effects. And so when we give ourselves a mantra to say over and over and over again, then it's like that elephant holding that stick of bamboo. We're not grasping and clutching at all kinds of things to distract us. We're not grasping and clutching at illusion. We are holding on to that mantra, the name of God, or the name of a God quality, such as beauty, peace, love, kindness, reconciliation, joy, whatever it is for us. If we continue to say that mantra over and over again, then that becomes our reality. And that was true for Gandhi, by the way. It started when he was really young, and he started saying Rama, 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 and he would walk through wherever he was, whether it was India or when he was in England or in South Africa, just walking fast and saying Rama, 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 Rama. And there is a story that when he died, he actually said that. He said either Hey Ram or Rama. Some people dispute that, but I want to believe it's true, so I'm saying it's true. Because he absolutely knew that God was working through him, and the mantra helped focus him on that truth. I'm smiling because, you know, I've known for a while that that Gandhi was not afraid of death, and that's part of the reason that he was able to take the risks that he did, that he reconciled his relationship with death, knowing that he would be consumed again back into that ocean, into that awareness. And I remember talking to my friend Nipun one time. Many of us know Nipun Mehta, who is the director of Service Space, which is a global service organization. Nipun's right over there. Hi, Nipun. And I remember talking to Nipun, and he's got a very boyish energy, and he was talking about how when Gandhi was starting to sort of be much more of a I guess, political figure, a spiritual political figure, that his people wanted to get him a bodyguard. And Gandhi refused. He said, no, I don't need a bodyguard. And Nipun, in his boyish way, said, you know, because if somebody shot Gandhi, Gandhi would say, ha ha, the joke's on you, ha ha. And I'm like, did Gandhi really say, ha ha, the joke's on you? Maybe he said something like that. He did say, in my opinion, Ram, hey Ram. Again, as he was aware that death would only liberate him into that sea of beingness, that sea of awareness that he already was, but he would have a fuller realization of it when he was no longer in his body. And so Gandhi applied this idea, this mantra of being one with God and refusing to do things like other people did them and finding his innate courage. And all of that brought him to a place where he was able to release his ego and just allow the flow of spirit to move through him in a very gracious way, in a way that changed the world, in a way that changed lives, in a way that made the world better for many, many people. I'm going to read a quote from the book that refers to Gandhi. And this quote says, "Take yourself to zero. Not for yourself, but for the world. For Gandhi, action aligned with truth, that gave him true power, true soul force." And soul force means holding to the truth, or holding to our dharma, or holding to our word of purpose, no matter what, no matter how fierce the storms are. And we can do that when we want nothing for ourselves. The truth of a believer is not afraid of entering any conflict for the sake of others. And the believer enters into conflict without hostility, without resentment, without resorting even to violent words, because the believer doesn't need anything. The believer already has what we all seek, which is the truth. In the face of the fiercest provocation, the believer never lets himself forget that he and his attacker are one. This is the true spirit of ahimsa, or nonviolence. But ahimsa is more than just the absence of violence. It is the presence of justice and love. Gandhi always made it perfectly clear that it is our object to convert, not to coerce, the wrongdoer. And what that means is that we want to change and liberate the person who is perpetrating injustice, who is treating others unfairly, who is even resorting to violence. We don't want to coerce them. We want to convert them. And I would even take that one step farther, even though it's not a verb. I would say we also want to compassion them. To borrow from the teachings of Jesus, love our enemies. The teachings of many spiritual teachers, but Jesus was the one I happened to grow up with. Love your enemies. So, speaking of that, compassioning people versus coercing them. This is what I meant before, at the very beginning of this talk, when I said that there is work to be done. Many of you know that I belong to an organization called Braver Angels, where we work with reconciling polarities in the political system. We look for purple people, people that are not extremely red or extremely blue, but we try and help bring people together into a purple zone where they are at least willing to express compassion for the other's point of view and express compassion for this point of view, and where they are willing to understand. They listen for compassion and understanding. They do not partake in the four horsemen of the apocalypse, sorry, the four horsemen of polarization. And I have to read them because I always forget what they are. But we do not stereotype, we do not ridicule, we do not dismiss, we do not express contempt for the other. Instead, we lift them up in compassion and understanding. And I think that's what we're called to do now. You know, it's part of Braver Angels. All of us were asked to sign a pledge, and for some reason, I did not sign it. Even though I believe in it, I just wasn't ready to sign it. I'm just not there yet. But this pledge, it's from one of the name Braver Angels is sort of a takeoff on one of Lincoln's speeches, where he talks about mobilizing our better angels. And this pledge was called, Not absence of malice. Without malice, right? What's that quote? Malice toward none. Thank you. Malice toward none. Take the malice toward none pledge, where it says that if our side wins, we will not gloat and we will not demean or dismiss the other side. And if our side loses, we won't attack the side that won and we won't try and take anything from them. And we will, again, continue to work for greater understanding. Because, you know, we saw the charts. We saw red and blue, neck and neck. And this is not the first time this has happened. It's happened a lot. But what if between the red and the blue, and I believe this is purple because I've looked at, I believe that this is true because I've looked at charts according that support this theory as well, where there's a lot of red, which is right. Okay, a lot of red over here on the right, there's a lot of blue over here on the left, but in the middle there's this huge mound of purple on this chart. You know, people that, okay, I accept some of this over here, and people that say, oh, I accept some of this over here. You know, and one of our challenges as a nation, that one of the reasons that we've become so polarized, I think, is based on this idea that I expressed and was supported by in this conversation that I had with one of our local political officials. And she was saying that over here you've got this group, over here you've got this group, and some people from this group may be interested in learning a little bit more about what this group has to say. So they kind of sneak over there and they start going this way, and then this group gets afraid and they start pulling them back and they say, you are no longer one of us if you even ask a question over here. And the same thing is true on this side. Somebody on this side wants to hear a little bit more about what this side has to say. Maybe there's some sense in that. Maybe there's some goodness in that. And so they sneak over there, and they try and listen just a little bit. And then this side says, oh my gosh, you're not one of us. You're abandoning us. And they pull them back. And so that's part of what happens with polarization. So that's what I'm asking us. That's the charge that I'm asking for all of us today. Even if it hurts, even if it feels like it's not your dharma, dang it, it's mine, and I want you all to do it with me. Just can we let go of any sense of wanting to gloat? Can we let go of any sense of wanting to punish? And can we just instead transform all of that into compassion and understanding and grace and all of those beautiful qualities in the ocean of goodness that wants to express through us in new and possible ways? Because this is not a bad thing. This polarization that is happening, the stress of this past week is not a bad thing. It is an opportunity. It is an opportunity to grow wiser spiritually, to grow broader in our compassion, to lift ourselves up, to walk with faith and not sight, because we don't know what the outcome is going to be of any of this. We don't know what the outcome of America is going to be, but just to continue to walk with faith, to have faith in the value, to have faith in the principles upon which we were founded, to have faith in the innate goodness of people, even if they are behaving badly, to walk with that faith, and also to bring ourselves to zero. We do not need to be right. We just need to listen, and we need to understand, and most definitely, we need to have compassion, because that is who we are. And so it is my humble and solemn prayer, as I'm trying to do my best to bring myself to zero, that we can all get behind this, and that we can all do this together, and that we can be part of the healing of America. Let's do that now. Let us pray.